I think just like development, I think hiring well is a skill. You know, it's a gifting. I don't know that I have it. I this is not something that's come naturally. I had to work really hard at trying to hire well. And I think there's still going to be mistakes that are made.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're talking with Randy Searing, the Chief Executive Developer at Level 12, a custom software development organization in the Louisville area. Randy's story is instructive for software teams that are growing quickly. Early on, his hiring process was based a lot on gut feel, and as his team grew, he experienced what happens when our gut is wrong. In today's conversation, Randy shares the lessons he's learned through the years to identify good fit engineers for his team. We'll talk about why clarity of technical communication is the strongest signal for success. If you have any suggestions about people you want to see us interview, please tweet us at @woven_teams. We'd love to share their story. And now, here's my conversation with Randy Searing. Randy Searing, thank you so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks for the invite.
So what's the inflection point in your career that really got you to where you are today?
I don't think I can answer it with one. There's actually three significant ones that in my life. The first one is I really wanted to fly fly Apache helicopters in the Army. I was in ROTC and doing very well. And my senior year, I ended up getting an injury to my leg, thought it was an injury. Turns out it was a blood clot. And so that was enough for the Army to discharge me medically, which was really disappointing to me. I really liked that environment. I liked the structure. I liked the clear command hierarchy. And I had got a degree in computer science because it's a long story. I won't get into the because, but it's I never intended to use it. I liked it. I liked programming a lot. I never intended to use it as a career. Well, when that kind of tanked, I'm sitting there January of my senior year thinking, in May, I'm going to pin on second lieutenant bars. And instead, now I'm looking for a job. So the first job I got was actually as a network technician at a small ISP. And as long as their network stuff was running, they didn't want me to touch anything. So I took the programming stuff that I had and I looked for things that I can make better by programming. So I would say that was the first big inflection point where I transitioned from thinking I'd be in the Army to thinking I'd be, I'd actually have to do something with my programming background. The second one was about 9 months into that job, realizing that I wanted to go to seminary. So that's actually at the time I was in Missouri. We moved to Louisville, Kentucky to go to the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And I intended to do computers just to put myself through school. That's all I wanted to do. I thought at that point that I would leave seminary and become a pastor and, move somewhere. I didn't really plan to stay in the Louisville area. And in 2009, I had a friend from church tell me, basically, dude, you're not cut out to be a pastor. Don't do it. And I appreciated that advice and realized that what he said was most likely true. So at the time, it was just me basically doing most of the development. And then I had a part-time developer helping me. And I realized that if I was going to have a business, it might as well be development, what I'm doing. So we actually did a friend of mine. We had three partners at one time, and Level 12 was also doing system support, computer networking work. And in 2014, we moved away from that. And so to do solely development work. And so the second inflection point was really the friend just helping me to realize I wasn't cut out to be a pastor. And I was, instead of just doing technology work to put me through school, like that was going to kind of be a career now. And then the third big inflection point was in probably 2014, 15, somewhere in there. At the time we had one big customer that accounted for most of our work. We were a small team. I think we were maybe four or five people at that point. And the big customer had in the past given us kind of like, minimum monthly commitments per year. And they basically kind of said, we don't want you to go anywhere, but we're not going to commit to anything. Well, that was huge for me in terms of, okay, I just want to do development work and go home. Like I didn't really want to build a business. At no point was I ever coming into this as one of those entrepreneurial people who just loved the idea of running a business. In fact, there was a lot of things about it that I didn't like. And But at the time, you know, we had five people, and I thought, you know, my business partner and I both had families, and we had to give it a go. Again, we had to be good stewards of the opportunity that was in front of us. So that was really the third inflection point that made me realize I was going to have to take business development seriously and really try to actually grow a business. And I think probably, you know, 2014 or so.
So you were kind of chased by computer science and programming. It sounds like you tried to run away to the army, tried to run away to seminary, tried to run away to not starting a business, and it eventually caught you.
Yeah, I would say I enjoy the computer programming. So I wouldn't say I was chased by it. Like, in some sense, I would say I was enticed by it. I was definitely chased by the business. The business aspect has definitely been kind of a relentless pursuer who just won't go away.
Those economics are tough to get around. So
exactly.
It's kind of 2014. You're making that transition into you're going to run a business. So when did you transition into leading a team?
Well, the whole time I had really been leading. Even when we came together in 2009 as Level 12 3-in-1 Ventures, which was when we brought the system support stuff together, and our third business partner, who's no longer a part of the company, Mark. You know, when we came together, I was leading. I just kind of had that personality. I was kind of driving the charge. And so I would say the team and mentality in terms of software development, like realizing it's not just going to be me primarily leading this. I'm actually going to, you know, need to put some people in place who are as good as I am at development. And you know, it can't be me who's in the critical path. I don't know. Honestly, that's been a slowly developing thing for me over the past probably 4 years, like just realizing, okay, I need to set the vision and provide accountability, but I really need to give my people more freedom. And then ultimately, you know, 18, 24 months ago, realizing we need to take hiring seriously because it's getting harder and harder to hire. And so it's been a slow process for me. One of the reasons for that is I'm really care about attention to detail. I have really high engineering standards. And a lot of the difficulty that I have in turning things over is just a concern that things are not going to be done as well as I would do them. And so, you know, that's two things at least. One, getting the right people in place who have that gifting that they can really do the job well. And then number two, it's providing enough vision and coaching to make sure that we're not losing things in translation, and everybody has, that we have a culture of engineering prowess, engineering craftsmanship, so that I don't have to be a micromanager. I can operate at that culture level, and then it will hopefully more naturally flow from the rest of the team instead of them feeling like it's something that's been imposed on them.
Right. Versus like carrying the code on your back. I'm going to review all the code. I'm going to make sure it's good versus creating a system. That's a hard transition.
Yeah. And that's definitely, we've got 14 people currently. We want to hire a couple more. Most of those are developers. I think we've got, so out of that, I think 10 are developers probably. And so, yeah, like in reviewing everybody's code is not possible. Even our team leads struggle to, you know, review the code. They've got 3-4 people on each team, I guess. So,
do you remember the first hire you were responsible for when it came beyond just your partners?
The first hire, the very first hire I ever did was when I was still on my own and I was in seminary because I had got more work than I could do. And so the first hire was a friend of mine from church who I think at the time was in high school, but was transitioning into college. And, you know, it was just, he happened to run into me and we were talking and I was like, hey, let me let you try some stuff here. So that wasn't a very, I don't know. I didn't put much thought or effort into that. It just kind of worked out. I think that's probably maybe most people's first hire, but my second hire, I had to be a little bit more intentional about, and that was actually Matt, and Matt's actually still with me. He's been with me the longest. I think he's been with me since 2007. And again, at that point I put some advertisements out. He happened to apply and it just kind of worked. So I wasn't being very thoughtful or intentional at that point. I was just trying to, you know, deal with, at the time, you know, I just needed a part-time dev to help me sometimes. And so.
So that, did you learn anything from that hire? I mean, it seems to work out awesome. So hire more people like Matt.
Yeah, right. Like, honestly, if I could get 3 Matts or any of my kind of senior people, I'd take any of them. That would be fantastic. That's maybe what we need to do is get into the cloning business.
There we go.
Seriously, I really didn't start learning anything from hiring Honestly, again, the last 18 to 24 months where I've really started to take it seriously and really try to put effort into both where we're advertising and then what our hiring process is. It was too piecemeal. It was too, you know, a hire here this year and maybe not another one for an 18 months. You know, we went through some sales and business development people. We've definitely gone through more of them than we have developers up until recently. And so I had kind of more experience doing that, and I was bad at it, especially with business development, because it doesn't come naturally to me. At least with a developer, I can try to have a conversation with them and usually know whether or not they know what they're talking about. But it, you know, with the business development people, I hired a lot of people that I thought would be a good hire, and then, you know, they didn't turn out to be able to produce. And I don't know, like, even now, like, I still, there's some questions about the uniqueness of Level 12 and what we're trying to do and the type of customers we'd have to have. That makes it difficult, maybe more than average, to find people to talk to who are interested in hiring us.
So thinking about components of a good hire and a good career. So when it comes to natural skill, how would you rate the importance of that when it comes to hiring?
To me, and this might be controversial because I know there's a lot of push in the development space, especially as those who are trying to expose different segments of the population to software development, which is great. I'm all for that.
We need more developers, absolutely.
Yeah, we need more developers. But I think in the effort to make programming accessible to everybody, quote unquote, I think what's been lost is the reality that programming is a gift and a skill that not everybody has. And there's a difference between being able to do, you know, maybe the first two or three levels of some coding challenge or some, you know, school that's going to teach you to program, and the very complex multi-layer type of programming that has to happen when you get into production systems of any, you know, of any decent size. So honestly, to me, that natural ability, that natural skill, that gifting, that's actually what I like to call it. I like to call it a gifting. That gifting is the most important thing. I would take a really gifted senior developer who has no experience in Python or SQL. Let's say they were, I don't know how you get there, maybe embedded Linux. but I think I would rather have that person on my team. Maybe I may want to come back to this, actually, now that I'm saying it. I'm maybe not agreeing with myself, but maybe not that extreme of a separation in terms of experience from what, you know, what Level 12, the type of development we need to do. But I would definitely rather have that, or let me say it the other way. I would rather have a gifted mid-level developer with minimal experience in our stack than a senior developer who's been doing it for 15 years who doesn't have the skill, or they don't have that gift. Like, I think the mid-level dev would ultimately just grow into it and make that person who can make the intuitive right decision about how to balance the technical, the complexity of the technical skill. And then also that I got to get things done. I actually have to produce working code. I've got to get a deliverable to the customer. The person who can do that and balance those things and leave code that other experienced devs don't mind walking into, you know, to me, that's the gold standard. And I think it's more important than experience. Not to say that experience doesn't count. It does. But that gifting for me is the most important thing. And it's what I'm, much of my process, my hiring process is geared towards trying to discern whether or not the developer really has that gift.
How do you,
or maybe it's not binary. How much of that gifting they have is maybe the better way to say it.
So thinking about us as an industry, and I know you've worked a lot in your hiring process, how good do you think we are at finding that gift and identifying it, especially in junior engineers?
So the biggest piece of the puzzle for us, and I read this in some, you know, blog post or publication that I read at one point, it was a company who was evaluating, they were going through a bunch of basically hiring statistics. I forget exactly how they got them. And they came away with the one takeaway they said is that the key to hiring developers well, that the key to understanding whether or not that person has a high technical competency has to do with their ability. How well can they clearly communicate technical topics? So that's what they said. And that really resonated with my experience. So in terms of your question, the younger me, I've always felt this. I've worked with others developers And I don't want to sound prideful here in terms of my development ability. Like, there's a lot of gifted developers out there who are better than I am. But in the circles that I ran in and the contacts that I had, I was usually one of the best developers around. And when I happened to find somebody who could work at kind of the same level that I wanted to work at, and I didn't feel like I was having to slow down to work with them, man, it was always really productive. So I was aware initially of that, you know, of that gifting being present, because I could usually tell when I worked with other developers kind of how fast we could get things done, how good the code was. When we talked, did it seem like there was a synergy and thought process, or did I feel like I was speaking Greek and they were speaking French? And so there was definitely that feeling of work well. And I guess, you know, there's always the debate, well, was that just me and my personality kind of resonating with somebody else? Is that really the gifting, if that even exists? Well, I don't know. You know, again, I'm just one guy and my experiences are rather limited, but I do feel like it seemed to me like it was representing, you know, some type of technical gifting that a lot of people, even in the industry, didn't have. And so I don't know that I would have much advice to my younger self about what to look for in terms of that gifting. I was always aware of it. That one thing in terms of, you know, how well can they communicate on highly technical topics is really important. But again, like, it's not a slam dunk. I don't think there's a slam dunk in any of this stuff. Like, I don't have a single metric that helps. I have some metrics. You've helped us develop one that I've really come to appreciate and rely on, but it's just one. And so I think, you know, we put all of this stuff together and then it's still somewhat of a subjective decision. And now I'm kind of blanking on what your original question was, so I'll stop and see if we need to rein it back in a little bit.
So it sounds like you don't have a lot of stuff that you're confident in that you've learned versus the past. You think there's still that gift and that fit that you feel, and you try to get a lot of data points to predict it, but there's no silver bullet.
Exactly. And even within all those data points, we still sit around my development team. I've got two team leads. My development leadership team is two team leads, myself and my business partner. And so we still sit around and debate, regardless, even though we have that one particular thing we're looking at, and it's kind of high on the radar, there's still lots of other things that come into it, like what kind of experience do they have? Does it line up with the type of stuff they do? Do they seem like somebody we could put in front of a customer or not? We've got a place for both, but that's one of the things that we consider. You know, do we like the person? Like, do we gel well? Do we like interacting with them? And ultimately, do we think that they can be a, you know, productive member of the team, which again is subjective. So even with the data points that we have, it's still a subjective process. I would love, you know, as a developer, I would love to have the algorithm that predicts success at level 12, both for our sake and our candidate's sake. But I don't think that's realistic. I think just like development, I think hiring well is a skill. You know, it's a gifting. I don't know that I have it. I this is not something that's come naturally. I had to work really hard at trying to hire well. And I think there's still going to be mistakes that are made. So yeah, definitely a fluid process for us. Still trying to learn, getting feedback from you, trying to evaluate our own experiences. And I guess if I could go back, you guys wouldn't have existed, you know, probably, maybe. I don't know when exactly your start date was. But if I could go back, I would have never hired a developer without what you guys have done for us. Like, that one piece of information, and I'm not sure it's, you know, I'm not sure it's perfect. Again, we're still even iterating on.
It is not perfect. I can see that.
Yeah, but having that one piece of information with a relatively little engagement of our time and a relatively little engagement on the candidate's time would have saved us, like, and honestly, so this actually, I think, dovetails well into your question. So, you know, what would I have told my younger self? I'm thinking like way younger, but really even like, you know, 18 months younger. I hired a candidate at the end of 2017 now, who started working for us in 2018. And all the skills tests I did said, you know, probably average gifting, but mature developer. And so we wanted to give him a chance, thought it would probably work out pretty well. We had some concerns, but for the most part, we're optimistic. And he bombed really hard. And that was actually, it was that interaction that made me ask, what did I miss? I've got 16 hours of skills tests. I brought that guy on for an on-site interview. I had some concerns, but I had no really big red flags. And he did really poorly at level 12. despite, and I think we gave him 5 months, like we gave him a decent amount of time and coaching to try to turn things around. He just was not able to do it. And so we started asking some really hard questions about why was he not successful at level 12? What about our environment allowed him to be successful at his previous job, but not ours? And what we came away with was had to do with communication of technical topics, and in particular, that ability of a developer to break down business requirements in their mind quickly and understand how that's going to impact the code in the job, so they can give immediate feedback during a conversation and, you know, have that dialogue, whether it's with their team lead or an architectural meeting that we're having or with a customer, that ability to really quickly kind of walk up and down that stack in terms of the top of the stack would be the very high level business requirements. What is the business trying to do? Why? What value does that give them? What kind of risks are involved? What kind of challenges are the people going to have using the software? And then the very low part of the stack would be, well, what actual code is going to be written? What data structures are we going to use? And so a developer's ability to walk really quickly up and down that stack is what we realized that particular employee did not have, and what we realized was really essential to how we do development at level 12. Because our hierarchy is very shallow. We basically have the customer, a team lead, and then the developer. And we want to minimize how much work the team lead has to do in terms of really breaking down a project for a dev. We need a dev to be part of that conversation, asking questions, pushing back if necessary, building that mental model of what they're going to have to build, and then go put that in an issue and then go work on the project. And we just found that candidate did not have, or that employee did not have, that ability. And so that actually became the kind of the key thing that we started working with you guys in terms of how do we test for this, because it seems to be the one thing that you could potentially get through the rest of our process with, and we wouldn't necessarily know it. So we're both testing that one, criteria. We're doing that with you guys on the front end in the exercise you've built for us. But then actually now the very last step of the hiring process, the online or the on-site interview, is actually totally geared toward that whole thing. So we've got a little bit of information. Well, it's really not a little bit. I think it's a pretty good handle on a candidate's ability to do that on the front side. We've got skills tests in the middle. We've got a remote interview just in terms of getting to know the person. Or we've got a phone screen. Then we've got a remote interview with all of the dev leads. And then at the very end, we've got that on-site interview. So I'm really bookending the engagement with the candidate on the front end with the exercise that you're doing for us. And then on the back end, really vetting, hey, we sit down, we have a really real world problem. We do kind of the vision transfer step. We're most of that for us is gauging how that vision transfer step goes. And then we actually turn over the rest of the day. So it's basically that last interview is kind of a working day for us. We take a very real world problem with some unique challenges. We sit down, we talk to the candidate about that. We work through the problem with them. We let them kind of come up with the architectural solution. We let them ask as many questions as possible. It really truly is a dialogue to try to figure out what the best answer is. And then we let them actually go kind of edit the code and see how far that they can get.
So that is a lot of information. That is 12, 16 hours of time with a candidate, or time seeing their work, it sounds like.
So it wouldn't be all that. So the skills tests that we do are remote. So we're not spending a whole lot of time with them during the skills test, but we do spend, we spend an hour plus on the phone screen. We spend roughly 2 to 3 hours evaluating their skills test with them remotely on the Zoom meeting. And then we spend, if that all works out, then we'll bring them in for an onsite and spend a whole day working with them. At the beginning, it's usually kind of everybody during the vision transfer step. And then once they kind of get their plan in place, then it's mostly whoever the team lead we think they would be would work with them.
Could you tell us a little bit about what you mean by vision transfer? I'm not sure if that term is.
Yeah. So for me, vision transfer is the active intentionality of getting what the customer needs. What is their context? What environment are they operating in? What are they trying to do? Why are they trying to do it? So they have a vision, if you will, of what their problems are, what their systems are currently as they exist, whether those systems are technology or processes. And then they have a vision of where what kind of problems they have or new things they want to do and what's the end goal. So the vision is given where I'm at right now, what's the goal?
Why is that important for an engineer to be able to do that?
Well, because you can create the best code in the world, and if you've built the wrong thing, it doesn't add any value to the customer. So for me, it's all about customer value. This is the heart of Agile, done properly, not Agile as it's kind of become an industry, but like Agile core principles is make sure you know the user, make sure you know what they need, make sure you're building something that actually has value for them. So for us, the idea of delivering customer value is paramount. Like I do not want to spend a bunch of time building something for a customer only to deliver it and have them go, this doesn't really get me where I'm trying to go. So we spend a lot of time trying to understand where they want to go. And then we spend a lot of time organizationally documenting that and trying to include the developers who are actually going to do the work in that vision generation and transfer process. So it's not always realistic to have the developer, you know, in the room when you're having those discussions or on the meeting. So the idea of vision transfer then is A, level 12 really needs to understand the customer vision, and B, level 12 as an organization puts a premium on getting that vision as pristine as possible passed down through the layers of our organization so that the developer who's actually doing the work has as clear a vision as possible about what they actually need to build and why. And the reason that that's essential is A, we actually want to deliver something that brings value to the customer, but B, developers, when there's confusion about what they actually need to do, developers' productivity dives, right? When I get something and I go, what am I supposed to do with this? I can't go start working on it. And I kind of tool around and maybe I don't push back like I should on the team lead. Like, what do you actually want me to do this?
This kind of ties back to that technical problem solving, jumping up and down abstraction layers. It feels like there's a lot of alignment.
Yeah. And so we've had some devs who, when they get in that environment, they'll really just spin their wheels and they won't come up for air. They won't say, I don't have enough information. And that's been a problem.
It's frustrating. I've been there. It's tough. This show is brought to you by my startup, Woven. At Woven, we help software teams hit ambitious hiring goals. We do that by improving the fuzziest step in the hiring process, candidate screening. By giving every candidate a fair chance to show what they can do, our customers find more great candidates and they back their decisions with evidence to remove bias. If you want to learn more about how Woven could help you scale your development team, check us out at woventeams.com. Walk me through the interview that had the most lasting positive impact on your impression of a candidate.
It wasn't actually an interview. It was part of a skills test that they did. They submitted a skills test that failed, and I noticed that they added tests to the project. And so when I looked at the test, it really surprised me that they would submit a failing test. Why wouldn't you fix it? And there was nothing in the notes about not fixing it. And so I ended up running the test and looking at the commit log and realized we have a bonus in one of our skills tests. They had actually done the solution correctly, wrote the correct test, and then accidentally broke it during the bonus. And so that actually was a really positive thing for that candidate. They probably saved themselves not getting rejected at that stage, because I would never have gone through the Git history and tried every commit to find the one that passed if they hadn't had a test there. And we actually ended up hiring that developer, and that's turned out to be a great hire for us. So that was not exactly what you asked, but that's the one thing that stands out that I can think of.
What advice do you have for an engineer looking to get hired on your team?
Recognize that the hiring process is very difficult from the employer's perspective. We only get so much data to make decisions with, and that data is not perfect. And if you get rejected, the advice would be, don't fear rejection. I know that's really hard, but when I reject candidates, it is not because I think they're bad developers. It might not even be because I don't think they'd work at level 12. It's kind of the opposite scale. It's more like, I'm not certain. I don't have a high level of confidence that they would be a good fit. And I don't want to accidentally get them in a position that I can't be confident they're going to succeed in. So it's very possible that we passed on applications of developers that are very good developers. We probably are passing on applications of developers that would do very well at level 12. But we only have a very limited set of criteria that we can use, and sometimes that stuff doesn't show it. So if I had a chance to sit down with people and talk to them and really get to know them, work with them for a month, I am certain that there are some candidates that we are passing on that I would have been like, I can't believe I passed on you. So just remember that we don't have that. It's really not personal. Like the amount of information I get is incredibly minimal. And when you get passed up, just recognize that that's probably as much a result of the potential employer's finitude as it has anything to do with your application or what you might actually in reality be able to bring to the table for that potential employer.
That's a really good reminder. It's a flawed process and there are lots of great candidates, and it doesn't mean that they should quit or find another job. My guest today has been Randy Searing. Randy, thank you for being on Scaling Software Teams.
Yep, glad to be here. Thanks, Wes.
Thanks again to Randy for sharing his journey into engineering leadership. I really enjoyed talking to Randy because it highlights the importance of an effective hiring process that isn't built on just our gut. My team works closely with Randy, and one of the things that makes Randy an effective leader is his rigorous focus on process, systems, and structure. Here are a few takeaways I had from my chat with Randy. On his team, natural problem-solving ability is as important as coding knowledge. There are plenty of elements of software engineering that we can teach, but problem-solving is definitely a skill that's not evenly distributed. Folks who are great problem-solvers can learn new tech. Incorporating problem-solving as a critical part of our screening process will help us hire the right engineers as our team grows. Clarity of technical communication is a powerful hiring signal. Randy's team can write the best code in the world, but it doesn't matter if they don't build the right thing or they can't work together as a team. That's why he looks for engineers with a keen ability to communicate technical issues in clear, non-technical language. Hiring is critical when scaling. Finally, something I really enjoyed about my conversation with Randy is that he views hiring as an improvable skill. It's a process, and it's as important as any when we're scaling our software team. It's something that we need to put work into and grow our capabilities in. It's not enough to go on gut feel. We need to put in the work, gather as much evidence as we can, and make rational, structured decisions. As Randy pointed out, just like development, hiring well is a skill. I heard a lot from Randy today about what skills make a great fit engineer, but now I want to hear from you. Who are some talented engineering leaders you think I should be talking to? Email me at wes@woventeams.com or tweet at me at Wes Winham. I read every response and I'd love to hear from you. I'm excited to learn along this journey with you, and I'm always looking for your feedback about how to make the show better. If you have anyone you think I should interview, tweet me at Wes Winham or @woven_teams and I'll reach out. Thank you so much for listening and subscribing, and I'll see you next Monday.